It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, people make fun of those online cat videos, but people keep watching them. Our guest tries to answer the question, why? What do we get out of it? First, Wisconsin's Assembly passed the $72 billion state budget early this morning, sending it to Governor Scott Walker for a signature. This afternoon, they also passed a ban on abortions in the state after 20 weeks of pregnancy, also sending that to the governor. Walker has said he won't announce his intentions to run for president until the state budget is signed. He'll be able to make that deadline, but it'll be a tight turnaround before his planned Monday announcement. Remains to be seen how he might change the document with his line item veto power. Walker has also said that he would sign that 20-week abortion ban if it reaches his desk. Well, now it will. Here with us to talk about the state budget and this abortion bill is Scott Walker, Associated Press correspondent covering Wisconsin state government. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about what changed, what hasn't changed in the budget. The Senate passed it earlier this week. Did the Assembly do anything different, or is this just a carbon copy of what went through the Senate?
No, the Assembly did not change anything. If they had, that would have required it to go back to the Senate, and that's not what anybody wanted to happen at this point. The Senate made a couple significant changes when they took it up earlier in the week. They did add in the repeal of the prevailing wage on local government projects. Prevailing wage is a formula that sets a minimum salary for construction workers on public projects. That got added to the budget. And they also repealed or took out a late addition related to the open records law that got a lot of attention. It had been added into the budget late last week in the last meeting of the Joint Finance Committee. There was an immediate and loud uproar, bipartisan objection to what amounted to a gutting of the open records law. And they quickly retreated on that. So the Senate made those changes, a number of other things they did. Didn't get as much attention or weren't as significant as those two, and sent it on over to the Assembly. And after about 12 hours in session, they passed it early Thursday morning around 12:40.
And there was an interruption there due to the bomb threat at the Capitol. Where were you, Scott Bauer, during the great bomb scare of 2015?
I was in the press room in the Capitol right outside the Assembly chamber. They evacuated. They announced that they were clearing not only the Assembly chamber and not only the entire Capitol building, but the entire grounds outside the Capitol, which was being populated at that point by people for the concerts on the square last night. So it was quite a scene as the police tried to clear both the grounds and the inside of the building, bring in bomb-sniffing dogs, clear the building and get everybody back in there. It was a process that took about 2 hours delayed debate a little bit. But again, yesterday in the Assembly was rather anticlimactic when it came to the budget debate because the Senate had taken it up first. Everyone knew that the Assembly was not going to change anything. So it was just a matter of waiting for that vote.
So the next step is for Governor Walker to sign this budget, maybe with some changes with his line item veto power. What's the buzz? Is there a thought that he might change much, or do you think, or is the thought that he'll take what they've given him and sign it as is?
You know, he's playing his cards pretty close to his vest when it comes to the vetoes. Most governors do, but most governors do issue a significant number of vetoes, some more consequential than others. I look back at the last budget, which was also passed with a Republican legislature, and I think then Walker issued 57 vetoes, somewhere around there. I wouldn't be surprised if you're in that range again this time. Typically, governors look at things that were added by the legislature that they disagree with. Sometimes they look at kind of scaling back or tweaking things that are in there as opposed to outright vetoing. And, you know, a lot of times you get things that are just kind of not even technical, but just things that are just trying to clarify maybe what had been done. There could be more substantial things. Again, he hasn't said yet what he intends to veto, but I think most people do expect him to announce those fairly quickly.
Yeah, with this presidential announcement scheduled for late Monday afternoon, early Monday evening, he would have to sign the budget by then to meet his goal to have the budget signed by that announcement. Is that normal to have one turned around that quickly?
And it has happened before, not recently. Governor Doyle, a Democrat, in 2007 and in 2009, released his budget vetoes with 2 days after the budget passed. So if Walker, sticks to that kind of timeline, you're looking at perhaps late tomorrow or Saturday, maybe more likely on Sunday, that he would put out his vetoes. Walker has signed two-year budgets since he's been in office, and both of those were a little bit longer turnaround. I think they were more like a week or 10 days. But you're right. I mean, he had been saying for a long time that he would not announce his presidential campaign until after the budget was signed. When it looked like the legislature wasn't going to get done anytime soon, he started to back away from that and said, well, you know, anytime after the budget year's over, which was June 30th, he'd make his announcement. But now he's got that window again to get it signed, get it done, get it out the door, and then he can put all of his attention toward running for president.
Talking to AP correspondent Scott Bauer about the latest action, mostly in the state assembly. And Scott, let's turn from the budget now to the 20-week abortion ban that passed earlier this afternoon. Again, probably a little anticlimactic. Did anybody expect this to not pass today?
No, it's a Republican-backed bill. There were no Democratic votes for it. It passed the Senate on a similar party-line vote earlier. It now goes to the governor. He has said he will sign it, and so that that appears to be where we're headed. I guess the only drama left to see on this is what kind of lawsuits get filed, which would seem to be inevitable with this type of legislation, which may hold up, when it takes effect. And there may be a question as to when the governor signs it, if he wants to do it concurrently with the budget, get it out there quickly, maybe have something he can talk about next week as he flies around the country. But, his support for the bill, he's made that clear. And so, again, like you said, there wasn't a whole lot of drama today. Everybody knew how this play was going to end.
Now, other states have passed similar abortion ban, late-period abortion ban legislation, usually under Republican control. Anything unique or that stands out about what has passed in Wisconsin's legislature now?
The one thing that got some attention throughout this debate is that there are no exceptions for the health of the mother or cases of rape or incest. The governor, the Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald, had said that the governor told them that he would sign it that way without the exception. The governor has talked about how he didn't care whether that was in there or not. So that's something that's interesting, that's gotten some attention. Without knowing in detail what the other states' laws look like, I get the impression that Wisconsin's is fairly on par with those other laws.
And as you mentioned, lawsuits expected here. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel quoted some legal experts from across the political spectrum saying, as things stand now, this probably won't hold up in lower courts, could find its way to the Supreme Court. What are you watching for to see whether this thing is going to pass court muster as we move forward?
It all depends on, who brings it, where the case is going to go, and things like that. I think, one point that has been brought up is that there are very few abortions in the state that fall within this time period. I think it's like 2%, something like that. So you're not talking a large number, but again, with this issue, as we saw with the previous law he signed related to admitting privileges for doctors to perform abortions, that was successfully fought in court. This one will be taken to court. So it's just another fight moves to another venue.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
You bet.
That was Scott Bauer, Associated Press correspondent covering Wisconsin state government. So looking at the state budget and a 20-week abortion ban, both passed the assembly. They are on their way to the governor. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, as Medicare and Medicaid turn 50 this month, we look at how these programs have shaped life in America and what their future holds. First, if you ever catch yourself blowing off work to watch a funny cat video online, maybe you don't have to feel so guilty anymore. According to new research, these cat videos can help us repair bad moods, restore some of our energy. And with over 26 billion views of over 2 million cat videos on YouTube, seems like a lot of us have figured that out. Our next guest studied the effect of cat videos. She's an assistant professor of journalism at Indiana University. Jessica Gall-Myrick, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So, Jessica, given how many of us watch these cat videos online, have we paid enough attention as to why we're doing it?
Well, that was kind of my goal with this study. I study media for a living, and just sort of struck me one day as I saw all these cat videos in my social media feed. I read a news article that celebrity cats sometimes make more money than human actors. That this is a major part of our media diet. That stat you quoted, the 26 billion views, I mean, that's way more than the average New York Times article gets a day. So I think we need to understand how this type of media use impacts us if we want to understand the role of the internet in our lives.
Right, and this is like the joke about the internet, about how frivolous right. all the stuff is, how we waste our time, and you're thinking maybe there's something more to it.
Right. I mean, obviously the internet is very new, but media is not. And for decades, we've used media to sort of regulate our feelings, whether we know it or not. And there's a long line of research about mood management theory, and it argues that we turn to media that will change a negative mood state or maintain a positive one. And that's basically what I found in my study, was that people were watching these cat videos and reported that afterwards they felt more hopeful, more content. They even felt more energized than they did before they watched them.
So you surveyed about 7,000 people about their cat video viewing habits.
Yes.
What were some of the basics about the hows and whens and whys they watched?
Yeah, so I asked all sorts of questions because no one had really tackled this empirically before. I wanted to get as much data as I could from those cat video watchers. I found that most of the people reported not intentionally seeking out cat videos. Instead, they about three-quarters of the time just happen to be online and encountering them. I think that speaks to the massive amount of this type of media that's out there. I found that people who were shy but also agreeable in their personality traits were more likely to watch cat videos than others. I found people who had a real cat were also more likely to watch cat videos. But interestingly, fans of cat videos sort of ran the gamut from cat people to dog people to people who liked both. So it's really a pop culture phenomenon.
So let's get into a little more the benefits. You pointed out, more energy, busting bad mood. So how did people report that? How did they describe what they got out of these cat videos?
Yeah, so I talked about the positive moods and the energy benefit. They also reported feeling less anxious afterward, which I argue could mean we might be able to use these videos as a form of digital pet therapy. I mean, having a pet is great. I have a dog, and it's wonderful, but it can be expensive. If you have allergies, it's not really feasible. This is a really easy way. You can pull out your smartphone, and if you notice you're clenching your jaw at work, just take a couple minutes, de-stress, watch a funny cat video, and then go and tackle your next task.
Well, even for people with pets, the pet therapy probably won't help them in the middle of their work day. There aren't a lot of workplaces where any pets are welcome, much less cats.
Exactly. Yep.
Your office mate doesn't always want the litter box there, for one thing.
yeah.
But what it makes me think about, people seek out positive things online to boost their moods. But there's a lot of negative stuff that can anger people up on the internet, and obviously it's fairly popular too. So how do both of those forces balance out? I know you didn't look at the negative stuff in this study, but how do you think that might what might justify all that stuff?
Right, sure. So we have a lot of different motivations for using media. One motivation is what we call the surveillance function, so to try to figure out what's going on in our world. So that's where you might encounter some negative information. We like to compare ourselves to each other, and social media is very good for that as well. So a mood boost is just one of many different motivations we have to use media, and I think we might see more of these cat videos pop up to sort of balance out that negative content. By taking a break from long, difficult article about partisan bickering, to watch a cat video might help you make it through the article later when you return to that tab. So we spend a lot of time with media. The most recent surveys find that Americans spend between 10 and 12 hours a day with some form of media or another. So I think cat videos are just happen to be one part of our media diet. I think they're probably a decent-sized part for some of us because of that positive mood hit we get, so to say. But there are other parts that serve different functions for us.
We're talking to Jessica Gall Myrick. She's at Indiana University. She did a survey trying to figure out why people watch cat videos, what, if anything, we get out of them. Turns out, according to what she learned in her survey, we get some, maybe an energy boost, maybe overcome some anxiety. It could be worth taking that goofy cat video break in the middle of a work day to charge us up for the next part of the work day. Now, Jessica, I don't know if you were able to figure this out, but why cats? There are a lot of potentially positive or silly or funny things we could watch online. What is it about cat videos that have really made them the defining trivial goofy thing on the internet?
Yeah, a lot of people have been asking me that since I did this survey. I think part of it is we actually have a long, long history of showing cats in the media. The ancient Egyptians painted cats, used them in hieroglyphics. So part of it's actually just cultural residue. I think the other thing about having cat videos online is that in person, cats aren't terribly exciting. No offense to the cat lovers out there, but, they're sleeping or they're hiding from you. Maybe they're, clawing at you. But these videos capture unique, sort of rare moments, and it's almost as if the internet is a dog park for cats. you're never going to get your own cat at home to do a trick on command. But online, you can see all these cats doing pretty novel things. So I think there's a novelty factor to the cat videos. Part of my research that found that people with a shy personality trait are more likely to watch cat videos jives with previous research on heavy internet users. So people who spend hours and hours online, they also tend to be shy. So there's a possibility that the people who use the internet the most are also cat lovers, and they're just producing more of this content. So that could be happening too. But I think we actually need more research to sort of figure out why. But I think it's this mesh of cultural factors and who uses the internet the most, and the fact that it's sort of interesting, unique to see a cat do something funny. Whereas in real life, we trained our dogs, we can usually get them to do something funny or cute on command.
Now, bigger picture, we've talked to guests here over the years about the negative effects of too straight up a news diet. Watching too much of the serious news, the negative news, increases your anxiety levels, may increase your feeling of disempoweredness. And then I think, okay, newspapers through the years have had comics pages and sports pages. Your local TV news has the light lifestyle features. People make fun of those sometimes, but maybe is there a case to be made in all these different media sources that there should be room for this lighter stuff to leaven the stuff that's going to keep us awake at night?
Definitely. I think that's a great analogy, looking at newspapers and comics. It is really hard to, especially in our globalized world, read about all the war and conflict and poverty there is abroad and at home. So this is, maybe an adaptation to the fact that we're not all reading the same newspaper or watching the same evening news anymore. But even in our filter bubbles or, our own very personalized media diets we have now, these cat videos are pretty much popping up everywhere. So it very well could be sort of an adaption of bringing that lighthearted moment, that breather, that little bit of mental space to help us deal with the information onslaught we have online. I mean, we are consuming more information than ever before in human history. So, yeah, I'm a former journalist myself. I've taught journalism. I'm a deep believer in that good hard news, but yeah, everyone can use a cat video every now and then.
So what's your next step in this kind of research and figuring out how we're using the internet and how it's affecting us, our mood, our psychology?
I've been telling people that this study was really exploratory. There wasn't much empirical evidence out there, so I thought it was important to do sort of a larger scale survey and get a broad picture of what's going on. I think the next step is to do some more controlled research, so in a laboratory, have people watching cat videos, other types of pet videos, and get instant feedback on their emotions, get some more reliable measures, and then have them read a hard news story or have them read a health story and see if they retain more information or not versus having watched or consumed some other type of media before. So I think going to the lab, getting some real-time measures will really be helpful for teasing apart how this uber popular media phenomenon impacts the rest of our lives, the rest of our media consumption habits.
And Jessica, I've got to ask, are you a cat video watcher? And did your cat video watching habits change from before to after doing this survey?
Well, you know, I watch a little bit. I live in Bloomington, Indiana, which is the home of Lil Bub, the celebrity feline. So I watch some Lil Bub videos every now and again, but I really hadn't been a heavy viewer. I have a dog person. I have a pug dog at home. But, man, after this survey sort of gained popularity in the media, everyone's been asking me what my favorite cat video is, so I've been watching a lot more lately to try to be a more educated consumer of this type of entertainment media.
An expert on the genre. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
It's Jessica Gall-Myrick. She's an assistant professor at Indiana University with us to talk about the psychology of cat videos. Tweet us if you're a fan of cat videos. Maybe tweet us a cat video, your favorite, at Central Time WPR. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host Veronica Rickert is out today. 50 years ago, this month, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed into law the Medicare and Medicaid programs, and with it changed the face of healthcare in America for generations to come. Today, Medicare and Medicaid cover almost a third of all Americans, well over 100 million people. While these programs have brought medical care to the majority of the country's poor and elderly people, they have also received criticism from across the political spectrum over those 50 years. To look at the history and future of Medicare and Medicaid, we have with us now Julian Zelizer and Keith Whalew. They're both professors of history and public affairs at Princeton University. They're also editors of Medicare and Medicaid at 50, America's Entitlement Programs in the Age of Affordable Care. Julian, welcome to the show. And Keith Whalew, thanks for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's start with the basics. A lot of times I think we slur them together, Medicare and Medicaid, as one word or use them interchangeably. Keith, can you start off by separating what does Medicare do, what does Medicaid do?
So we use them one after the other because they were passed simultaneously, but they have very, very different origins. Medicare, of course, is the program that covers health care for the elderly, for people over 65. It's signed into law on the 30th of July, 1965, and it has four different parts that it's acquired over the course of years: hospital insurance, medical insurance, Medicare Advantage, which came along in the 1990s, and then the prescription drug benefit, with which George W. Bush signed into law during his presidency. Medicaid has a kind of a legacy as a program for the poor, unlike Medicare, which is paid out of dedicated payroll taxes. So people have a sense that they paid in and they get out. Medicaid has long had the stigma of being a welfare program, and it's a program that depends on a combination of federal funding and states deciding to buy into the program to support the health access to health care for people both in poverty and then increasingly people over the poverty levels, in some cases 100% and more over the poverty level. The history is that, of course, Medicare was the centerpiece of that legislation in 65, and Medicaid was sort of an afterthought. It was thrown in the last minute by the House Ways and Means chairman in order to kind of scuttle opposition, and they both end up being really centerpieces of the U.S.'s commitment to the health care of the vulnerable 50 years later.
And with the recent passage of the Affordable Care Act, often called Obamacare, it was contentious, a rocky road to passage. Some people compare it and think back, oh, it wasn't easy and smooth sailing like back when Congress knew how to pass things. Julian, in your piece in this book, you say, no, this was really contentious. It was a rocky road to pass Medicare and Medicaid in the first place.
Yeah, I think we forget what the atmosphere was like in 1963 and 1964. The year before this passes, the American Medical Association attacks Medicare is socialized medicine, which is the term you don't want to be tagged with during the height of the Cold War. They conduct a massive campaign to kill the program. The AMA sends pamphlets to physicians' offices that are posted, which warn people who are leaving their doctors, if this bill passes, a bureaucrat is going to be making decisions about your health care rather than your doctor. And there's also conservatives in Congress, Southern Democrats who control the committees, like Wilbur Mills of the Ways and Means Committee, teaming up with Republicans, and they killed the proposal every time it came up for a vote under Kennedy, and even during Johnson's first year. So, you know, from the perspective of 1964, it still seemed low probability that this program was going to pass.
What put it over the top, Julian?
Well, most important was the election of 1964, creates huge liberal Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate, 295 Democrats in the House, 68 Democrats in the Senate, and many of the newly elected members were promising and eager to pass Medicare, regardless of what Lyndon Johnson did. And Barry Goldwater, who's defeated against Johnson in 64, one of the issues the Democrats really kill him on is that he opposed Medicare. So many Republicans come out of the election saying, we have to pass something. And the Southern Democrats, who controlled the committee, said, if we don't do this, the liberals are going to roll us in, and we're going to be on the losing side of this issue. So that election really changes everything.
Now, Keith, you started to touch on how these programs have changed over the years. Can you take us briefly up to the Affordable Care Act? How did Medicare and Medicaid grow in that period?
Well, the subsequent history of Medicaid was uncertain because it always depended on states signing on. And 5 years later, in 1969, more than a handful of states, I think it was about 12 states, had not yet signed on to Medicaid, including New Jersey. 1977, there was only one holdout, and that was Arizona, which ultimately signed on to Medicaid in 1982. So if you think that the slow progress by which states accept Medicaid expansion today is unusual, it's not. I think it's much quicker from 65 to 69 and into the 70s. But it gives you a sense of how this kind of commitment to health care, health access for the poor and people above the poverty line was growing in fits and starts in those first decades. I think the key issue, of course, is that it dawns on state governments as well as the federal government that there's a huge price tag associated with this federal and federal-state commitment. And as early as the early 70s and certainly by the mid-70s, there's an increasing anxiety about whether this commitment is sustainable, whether it's fiscally sustainable, and what it will do to the overall budgets in states as well as in the federal government. And in some ways, the politics of Medicare and Medicaid get tied into the broader politics of liberals and the conservative government, conservative ascendancy in the late 1970s into the 1980s.
Talking to Julian Zelizer and Keith Whalew from Princeton University, editors of the book Medicare and Medicaid at 50. This month is the 50th anniversary of the passage of Medicare and Medicaid. Julian, as you described the debate 50 years ago, leading up to a passage this month 50 years ago, it sounded a lot like the debates over the Affordable Care Act. How much did the debate over Obamacare reiterate these arguments that we were having 50-plus years ago?
Well, some of it was the same. So conservatives in both periods, and they were different then, they included Southern Democrats. Today it's primarily Republicans, used the same kind of arguments that a program which really wasn't going to take over national health care, they said that it would. They compared it with the kinds of health care programs then, and we did with ACA, that other countries have, that the United States shouldn't have. And they often use the argument that doing this would impede the freedom that Americans have to choose the doctors they want. But the current debate was different. Most important, Medicare and Medicaid are the laws of the land and they're huge programs. So when we were debating ACA, the reality is the government already does a lot of health care. And that's why some Tea Party Republicans were warning and opposing Obama's proposal by saying, get your government hands off my Medicare, warning that there would be cuts in those programs. So I think the landscape's changed. Health care's changed from the expansion of managed care to new kinds of technology that make treatment different. So we should be cognizant of the different landscape in which we are.
And Keith, in your piece in Medicare and Medicaid at 50, you talk about regardless of Election Day rhetoric, both parties, maybe for different reasons, kept expanding the scope of Medicare and Medicaid from the Clinton era on up to today.
That's true. I mean, you have to look past the easy rhetoric that says that that liberals are always in favor of larger government programs and conservatives are not. And the historical reality is that under Nixon, we have a dramatic increase in a new Medicare benefit for end-stage renal disease for people with kidney failure. George W. Bush, of course, establishes the prescription drug benefit, mostly driven by those sort of electoral realities, the desire to kind of bring the elderly over to the Republican camp and have a durable Republican majority. You also have even Ronald Reagan, who begins his career really characterizing Medicare as socialism, working in tandem with the AMA. In the 1980s, he reluctantly signs on to different forms of Medicare and Medicaid expansion, and in some ways not so reluctantly. So you have the situation where both liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats, have, despite whatever the rhetoric might suggest, embrace various forms of expansion, sometimes for their own electoral purposes, and also an acknowledgement of the fact that in a certain way these programs remain very popular. Popular not just with the beneficiaries, but also popular with the hospitals that derive a great deal of income from these programs, that have residency programs financed by these programs. In other words, there's a lot of spin-off into the private market that has benefited from these programs over the course of the decades. And this is something that I think any political figure has to contend with.
We're talking about the impact of Medicare and Medicaid on the 50-year anniversary this month of the signing into law of both those programs. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How have Medicare and Medicaid shaped the United States? Have they benefited you or someone you know? Do you worry that they're an entitlement that diminishes personal responsibility? Maybe they cost too much regardless of the benefit. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or call in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue our conversation with Julian Zelizer and Keith Whalew. They're both professors at Princeton University. We'll continue the conversation after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. On the 50th anniversary of Medicare and Medicaid this month, we're looking at the impact of these programs and their future, and we want to hear from you. Has Medicare or Medicaid helped you or someone maybe in your family? What do you think about the future of these programs as they've been changed under the Affordable Care Act, extended? What could the government do to rein in health care costs under these programs? Or do you just have a question about how these work and the politics surrounding them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Keith Whalew, professor of history with the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton, and Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs, also at Princeton. They are co-editors of Medicare and Medicaid at 50, America's Entitlement Programs in the Age of Affordable Care. Julian, costs of these programs, as they've been expanded over time, as they've been changed, a new subsidies added under the Affordable Care Act, is there a sense that Medicare and Medicaid costs are going to be sustainable in 10, 20, 30 years?
Well, there is. I mean, look, these are costly programs. Not only do they cost a lot now and cost more into the future, but they're taking up a bigger portion of the budget. And so that's become a debate. You know, do we spend too much on Social Security and Medicare compared to other kinds of programs when there's limited resources available. It's important to remember that Medicare and Social Security do draw from the payroll tax, not from general tax money. That's the Social Security tax. And the payback is big. And so we can't just talk about a dollar cost, but we have to talk about the kind of impact these programs have on providing the elderly with health care, on the kind of money hospitals and doctors derive from the existence of these programs. So we have to contain costs. We've gone through periods where in the 1980s we tightened regulations. But overall, I think these are actually programs that are doing pretty well.
And Keith, let's talk about that impact a little more. How have Medicare and Medicaid changed the way healthcare works, the way healthcare is delivered in the United States?
Well, it's a little, I guess, discussed fact that things like the existence of nursing homes would not be as they wouldn't be as prevalent without the kind of programs that exist, the kind of support that exists under Medicare and Medicaid, for that matter. And, you know, on the topic of the rising costs, it's also not as appreciated as it ought to be that Medicare went from being a fee-for-service reimbursement system where a physician would decide what the customary charge for a particular procedure would be. And in the early days, you would just bill and Medicare would pay it. In the 70s and 80s, Medicare came up with a fundamental innovation that has become part of the private insurance market as well, called diagnosis-related groups, DRGs, an approach to paying hospitals that says that, you know, for a particular diagnostic criteria, rather than paying you based on what you've done, we pay you based on what is normal within this diagnosis, and we actually exercise a certain amount of cost containment power by doing so. It's a large program that can wield its power to try to contain costs, and it's the model that's been taken up and carried forward not only within Medicare but also in the private sector. So the issue with Medicare and Medicaid is that they actually have the numbers of people covered to wield that kind of power to contain costs. And really, it's a political question whether they are allowed to do so, whether they're allowed to take those formidable 66 million people covered by Medicaid, 66 and counting, and 55 million and counting in Medicare, and actually use the power of numbers to contain costs. And it's something that there's been a pitched political battle over the last 20 years or so, and that's likely to continue.
Right. That's been an issue with pharmaceutical companies. A lot of advocates saying, hey, use this bargaining power to bargain for lower costs on medications, as you mentioned, millions of people in the program. That still hasn't happened. Do you think, Keith, that's going to change, those kind of negotiations and bargaining will happen in the future?
Well, I think it would be, given we have to reach a point, we will reach a point when the fiscal climate, when the monetary demands of these programs almost dictate that we have to use that bargaining power wisely. I mean, one of the byproducts of the Affordable Care Act is the creation of something called the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, in which we're trying to look at what does quality medicine look like in Medicare and Medicaid? What are good models for pursuing good quality rather than just sort of spending whenever we feel it necessary to? What are sort of, you know, good models that can be carried from one Medicaid program to another? So I guess what I'm getting at is that the power of numbers might help us to constrain costs, but also wise medical practice using models from one state in another might help us to constrain costs over time. But ultimately, I think there has to be a political will to allow Medicare and Medicaid to use the power of those numbers for bargaining.
Talking to Julian Zelizer and Keith Whalew. They are co-editors of the book Medicare and Medicaid at 50. Well, I want to look toward the future with a little lens from the past, Julian. Keith was saying earlier, after Medicaid was passed, states were slow to adopt it. Some states not even signing on for 10, even in one case, almost 20 years. Well, now the Affordable Care Act is in place. Not all states have adopted their own exchanges. Not all states have expanded Medicaid as is available under the Affordable Care Act. Do you think that this is going to be a similar pattern where it's not a permanent rejection? States are going to straggle in over the next 10, 15, 20 years?
I think the odds are yes. And so in some of the states where the Medicaid expansion has not yet taken place, you already see a lot of pressure from Republican governors to accept the money. They're battling with state legislators usually. And you're also seeing a lot of pressure from healthcare providers to take this federal money. And take the benefits that come with it. So I think between that and the benefits that come from the exchanges, there is a good likelihood that we'll see what we saw with Medicaid replicated, not only these programs taking hold, but actually expanding and becoming stronger.
I want to talk about the politics going back to before the period you cover in your book. Healthcare efforts have taken a long time. They've been highly contentious issues before, during, and after their passage, whether we're talking about Medicare and Medicaid or the Affordable Care Act. Julian, why is this such a contentious topic in American national politics?
Well, look, we developed a private health care system very early on in the 19th and 20th century. Physicians organized in the AMA very early. And before government programs were really introduced, we had a full-blown private health care system take shape. So every effort to push for strong federal intervention has had to take place over this private health care system, which kept getting bigger and bigger. And the government's also subsidized the private health care systems through tax breaks to companies. So I think this is a big part of why it's been hard to simply replace this big program. And then it's become symbolically the issue that many conservatives use to fight against big government.
And let me just add one thing to that, which is the irony of it is that the way we expand healthcare in this country isn't by socializing medicine. It's by creating programs that allow vulnerable citizens like the elderly and the poor to purchase healthcare with benefits to the private sector, so that after Medicare was passed, it benefited cardiology dramatically. Medicare Part B insured this group of physicians, excluding it didn't include checkups, but it meant that procedure-oriented specialists like cardiologists, particularly those who dealt with the above 65 group, procedure-oriented, technology-oriented specialists benefited hugely. It really fueled the growth of cardiology in the 1960s.
And we'll leave it at that point. Thanks to Julian Zelizer and Keith Whalew, co-editors of Medicare and Medicaid at 50.